Welcome back. Welcome back. I'm welcoming myself back. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We got a great show today. It's one I've been really looking forward to doing. At the back end of the show, I'm going to mark the new year by reminding us all of what we face and the struggle that's needed to save humanity and the planet. Now, I'm going to be replaying an interview I did with Claudia Kunz on Hitler's Germany and the lessons for today. Claudia Kunz is a historian of Nazi Germany and the author of Mothers in the Fatherland, The Nazi Conscience, and Other Works. Opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Raymond Lada. Raymond's a revolutionary intellectual and an advocate for Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism, and he recently wrote three key points on the imperialist and fascist logic of the Trump tax bill. And you can find that at revcom.us. And after the conversation we have with Raymond today, you're going to want to go there and find that, because there's a lot there that people need to understand about what's going on in the world today. Now, Raymond, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Michael. It's always
sure.
A pleasure.
Yeah. Well, I have a bunch of questions for you, so I'm going to just jump right into it, all right? Trump's new tax law, it passed shortly before the holidays, and it was warmly celebrated by fascists and roundly condemned by anyone with an ounce of compassion and heart. And in its wake, there's been a lot of people stepping up to denounce and condemn the new tax bill as a corporate handout driven by unmitigated greed, and talking about actually acting like it's like a lot of gigantically fat, you know, Mr. Monopoly's going out there and then chasing this stuff around. And it's all it is just a thing about unmitigated greed driving everything. And in a recent article in RevolutionRevCom.us, you argue that there's a whole hell of a lot more in the mix here than just that.
Yeah, Michael, we do have to go below the surface, beneath the surface, you're familiar with this, and really dig deep into what's going on here. Look, it is true, this is blatant and monstrous greed written all over the tax bill, but that is not what is fundamentally driving it. And this is what I address in the article, and I think it's very important, you know, for us to dig into, because on the one hand, you have the Trump administration shouting to the rooftops its rhetoric that happy days are here again, growth, incomes, and jobs, which is nonsense. But at the same time, this liberal progressive critique simply looks at this as a giveaway. And what I'm arguing in this article and what RevCom.us is putting forward in its analyses of the Trump-Pence fascist regime and what is happening right now is that all of this is springing from the more basic nature of this system, this capitalist imperialist system, and particular problems, contradictions, and compulsions that it is facing right now as the dominant economic and military power in the world, but up against big, big challenges. And how it is going to maintain its dominant position is really sort of what's being thrashed out and being policied out, if you will, by the Trump administration, this politically dominant sector of the ruling class, which is really putting forward a blueprint that is aimed at strengthening the biggest and the most predatory capitalists within the ruling class and their ability to compete in the world economy and to strengthen U.S. economic dominance. And this is happening in the context of a massive military buildup by the United States. And then you have the other dimension of this tax bill, which is that it is a war on the social spending programs of the last 90 years. And as the accompanying article to my piece, you know, describes it, you know, is advancing policies and politics of cruelty, you know, that's going to impact the poor and bring new poor into being, and also large sections of the middle classes, and especially those sections of society, those parts of society that are not part of the Trump-Pence fascist social base, the urban areas, the more liberal, secular, critical thinking sectors of society like the universities. So this is really what is going on with this tax bill, and it's not something that is readily apparent because it is so blatant in terms of, you know, how it is going to redistribute wealth upward and concentrate it in the hands of the top 1%. But that is not what is fundamentally driving it.
Mm-hmm. So again, that's a, although it's not an all-out assault on the poor driven by corporate greed, it is going to hit them very hard. And then you have this other question here, which is actually, I think, won't that create some problems for them too as well in terms of hitting the, what they're doing in terms of just ripping away everything?
Yeah, it is. It's true. This is very drastic. This is a radical restructuring of social spending. But I think we really have to pull the lens back and see what's going on. You know, I was mentioning this just earlier, that this is really a conscious and strategic move by these politically dominant sections, the fascist section of the ruling class, to deal with very big economic contradictions they're facing globally and with their great power needs as imperialists. And, you know, if you step back and you look at big changes that are taking place in the world capitalist economy, you know, what you see is that balance of strength among, you know, contending imperial powers is changing. You know, in 1960, the U.S. commanded about 40% of global world output. And today it's, you know, about 17-18%. And then you have the rise of China as a capitalist global rival to the United States. China is now the second largest capitalist power in the world. And it is, you know, advancing, you know, a geopolitical, geoeconomic agenda in Asia, Africa, in Europe. Its currency, the yuan, is playing a more important role in the world economy. And there is more intense competition in the world economy for markets, for raw materials. You know, markets like in East Asia, which is the most dynamic growth region in the world for new technologies. The U.S. is still dominant, but its dominance is now, you know, being eroded. And this is part of the picture, and a big part of the picture, that we have to grab hold of in understanding what's driving this tax cut, this attempt to restructure social spending, and also to bolster. And this is a big theme of my article, Michael, that what they are trying to do here is to shore up and bolster the domestic economic base of the U.S. empire so that it can advance, you know, this geoeconomic agenda to strengthen U.S. economic dominance in the world. And as I said, this is all happening in the context of, you know, Trump's call for a massive military buildup and nuclear modernization, and China, too, is increasing its military spending and its global political, economic, and military reach. So this is all part of what's driving this, that there's an underlying set of compulsions, if you will, pressures that this regime, the Trump-Pence regime, is addressing in a certain kind of way. And a lot of that pivots on a different geoeconomic strategy and very specifically this corporate tax cut to stimulate spending in investment in new plant equipment to boost productivity, again, as part of this attempt to strengthen U.S. economic dominance.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, because as you're talking, I keep thinking, okay, if you're talking about bolstering the domestic economic base and, you know, kind of carrying that out, it seems like there's, you know, how is this related to the changes in the balance of strength of all the different imperials? Because, in fact, even as you're talking, I keep thinking China, where China is actually emerging on the world level as a major problem, on one hand, a major problem for the U.S., but also kind of fitting into the other, to its relations with the Russians. And then the other, what's going on with the NATO forces and the kind of back and forth and the free-for-all that seems to be going on right now. It seems like things are like, it can look very chaotic. And then you think about, okay, the U.S. then going into this chaotic situation and basically throwing down around a lot of things that will have a major impact on many of the players in the world.
Yeah, I think this is true. I mean, that's part of what sort of the, what I like to call the method to the madness. I don't like it, but this is what, you know, I think we can correctly characterize what the Trump-Pence fascist regime, you know, is up to. It has, you know, a very mad, you know, sort of, you know, intense, hyper-nationalistic, hyper-aggressive posture. And again, the military buildup, Trump saying, if we have nuclear weapons, well, why can't they be used? What's the purpose of stockpiling something that can't be used? I mean, this, the threat to obliterate North Korea, I mean, this is all part of a calculus to advance this geopolitical and strategic agenda of U.S. imperialism, again, with this section of the U.S. ruling class in the dominant position in calling the shots. Now, it's interesting that at the same time that the tax bill was being passed, the Trump administration issued its national security document. This was on December 18th, and it was apparently, I mean, it's not officially, but apparently written by National Security Advisor McMaster. And it's a very militaristic document full of threats. And here, getting back to your point about China and Russia, it describes them hostile competitors, you know, quote unquote, as revisionist powers. By revisionist power, they mean, you know, setting out to remake the world economy and its rules. And it calls for the U.S. to be able to militarily, and I quote, overmatch the military strength of all these other powers combined. Now, the U.S. spends more on the military than the next 10 powers combined, but this document is calling for even greater military advantage. So what's happening here is that this is an effort to reassert U.S. hegemony, to now back that up with greater military spending and with this bullying and military threat. That document, the national security document, also, you know, is arguing that the U.S. has to have a greater capacity to fight far larger wars than it has in the past few decades. And then you come back to the Trump tax bill, because these things are all of a piece. That a big component of this is to stimulate capital investment. By that I mean investment in new plant equipment and technology. And the Trump administration has been putting a lot of emphasis on the energy sector, and that fossil fuels, and bolstering that. Certain sections of manufacturing and the industrial base of the whole military apparatus of the U.S. economy and the U.S. empire. So this tax bill is actually aimed in lowering corporate taxation rates. And again, we have to clear away the rhetoric and get to the reality of this. The reality is not what Trump says, that the U.S. corporate tax rate is the highest in the world. When you peel away allowances and exemptions, that tax rate, you know, goes from about 35 to about 26 or 27%, which is the average among taxation rates in the imperialist capitalist world. But in this situation of intensifying competition in the world economy, with China rising in strength and the shifting balance of power that I'm talking about, that corporate tax rate, even at an average level, is viewed as a constraint on the ability of U.S. corporations to invest, to boost productivity. So this corporate tax rate reduction is actually aimed at stimulating capital investment in some of these crucial sectors of the U.S. economy to strengthen the U.S.'s competitive hand. And again, this is very much overlaid with the military buildup as well. So this is what's kind of going on beneath the surface. And you mentioned some of the contradictions built into it. Well, yeah. I mean, on the one hand, other countries can reduce their corporate taxation rates, you know, in a competitive way. So then you're back to intensifying the competition even more. And also, there is no guarantee that the lowering of this tax rate is going to actually result in higher levels of, you know, what's called capital formation, investment in this new plant, equipment, technology, what have you. The last time corporations in the U.S. had less tax, if you will, the money did not go towards new investment, but rather towards buying back stocks in order to boost stock prices, or buyouts and investment in property and financial assets. This is all part of the anarchy, the feeding frenzy of late imperial capitalism. So it's a very dangerous game. Geopolitically, the tensions between the U.S. and Russia and China are growing. And it's also economically fraught with contradiction, because the lowering of the tax rate for corporations is going to result in deficits. Government deficits, by some estimates, $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion, and that can create new financial strains. So it's really a calculated gamble. And how this plays out is not at all clear. But these are the factors. You know, I wanted to kind of pull the lens back, you know, to help people understand that there's the whole backdrop of what's happening, the shifts in the balance of economic power in the world economy. There's growing geopolitical tensions. And at the same time, there's this problem in the U.S. economy that rates of capital investment, even though the economy has been growing some and there has been new business spending, it's not at a level that can significantly boost the productivity and the competitive strength of U.S. capital. And this is an attempt, a gamble, if you will, to address that.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Raymond Lotta. Raymond's a revolutionary intellectual and an advocate for Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism, and we're talking about his recent article, Three Key Points on the Imperialist and Fascist Logic of the Trump Tax Bill. Raymond, one of the things that you were just starting to hit at this, and it really kind of, it's very important because the initial thing that a lot of people actually looked at this whole Trump bill as, it was an attack on the people, and they didn't really see all the things that you're talking about in terms of what underlies it, what's actually pushing this whole thing forward. And I wanted to ask you about this because it's like there's a lot of stuff that actually is being put up for grabs right now. And people, the importance of people actually understanding the things that you're talking about, as opposed to just saying, and we hear this all the time, it's just these greedy swine, they're all running around, they're sticking their snouts in a bowl, and they're sucking up all the profits, and they're doing this all over the world. And it's acting like you've just opened the door and you let out this whole legion of blood-sucking reactionary capitalists and whatnot. And actually, there's a lot more to the picture than this, as you've been pointing out. But I think this idea of people understanding that it's not just a question of they're slamming the people. They are doing that. But they actually face some very real problems today that can't be resolved just by sort of the normal way things have gone.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is right. You know, it's funny. You know, you preface your question and your observation with certain adjectives, greedy, blood-sucking. You know, I mean, there's no adjective that can, you know, sufficiently describe the cruelty, the brutality of these people who rule this society and what they're capable of doing. I mean, look, Trump has his finger, you know, his hands on the nuclear trigger, and they are sitting out with their energy policies, with their rewriting of regulations to, you know, accelerate the devastation of this planet. I mean, we are facing an existential threat. I mean, the future of humanity and the future of this planet is really at stake. And where this is coming from is being driven by these underlying pressures and compulsions, and then you have a section of the ruling class, this fascist Trump-Pence regime being a concentration of it, which is willing to do what they're setting out to do, you know, in terms of this military buildup, their whole program and project. And, you know, these are very hateful, despicable people. You know, the chauvinism, the xenophobia, the women hating, you know, they are completely despicable. And yet, you know, they are being driven by the underlying nature of this system, and they have a response, you know, which has its own logic and rationale to it. You know, one of the things I point out in the article is that there are kind of four components to the Trump economic strategy. You know, and one is to build up the energy sector, and they want to build that energy fossil fuel sector up for two reasons. One, to spur profits, but also in terms of the international economy, to use oil and natural gas strength to exert greater leverage on world energy prices and on regimes like Iran, which they consider to be mortal enemies. So that's one component. Another component is what we're discussing, you know, rewriting regulations, environmental regulations, and the tax code. Another component is to rewrite and restructure trade agreements and the ways in which the U.S. interacts with the world system of trade. And this is to give more immediate advantage to certain sections of U.S. capital and also to bully other countries even deeper into submission. This is what they're trying to do with Mexico. So that's another component of it. And then to slash social spending. So there's a certain sick, demented logic to what they're doing, but it is being propelled by these underlying contradictions and difficulties, these objective developments in the world economy, phenomena like this level of capital investment, which is not sufficient to further and advance an agenda of economic maintaining and strengthening the U.S. competitive hand in the world. So this is all what's going on. And, you know, that's why I'm saying it's the back and forth between these really are ugly, despicable people. And there really is greed written all over this. But that's not what's the origin of what's taking place. And it's very dangerous. And, you know, it underscores even more the importance, you know, for people to understand what's going on. And that's why I would recommend that everyone go to revcom.us, you know, for coverage of what this regime is doing. And also, it underscores the need for us to redouble our efforts to drive this regime from power. Because, as I said, they are posing an existential threat to humanity and to the planet, and drive this regime from power through massive, sustained, nonviolent mobilization, what Refuse Fascism has called for. So really what this article and these articles in RevCom are talking about is getting a real scientific understanding of what's going on and what the challenges are before us.
Raymond, we have about probably 5 or 6 more minutes, and there's one question I just have to ask you. I was thinking that would have been a great way to wrap this up. That's what I was looking at, but I think actually there's one big question, and that is you point out that the taxes on corporations are used to underwrite, as you've been saying, the capitalist imperial state, which safeguards and advances the strategic interests of imperialist capital. And Trump's bill cuts corporate tax rates, and things could get very dicey here because they actually depend on the state. They actually need the state in order to carry out what they're doing. They need to cut taxes, and they can't just throw away the capital state at the same time. Let's talk about that, because that could be a very dicey contradiction in terms of all the various elements in society and what is possible if things just like begin to go different directions.
Yeah, this is one of the points that I get into in the article, and here's what we're dealing with, this contradiction. The state, the imperialist state, plays a very necessary role in terms of the maintenance of this American empire. It safeguards the strategic interests of the capitalist imperialist ruling class. It does that through the military spending, the system of repression. I mean, we are talking about a state that is responsible for the bases that the U.S. has around the world, for its whole network of client regimes that are bolstered by foreign assistance and military aid, the wars that it wages. So this is what the imperialist state does. It also invests in research and development, infrastructure, you know, these kinds of things. And that state and its expenditures depends on revenues, on taxes, and on corporate taxes. Now, those taxes from corporations that they're paying, you know, let's say the true effective rate before this tax bill went in was about 26-27% of corporate earnings. But those earnings are based on the exploitation of wage labor, you know, in the U.S. and throughout the world. The whole network of sweatshop production, those taxes come from the exploitation of labor. Those taxes are a deduction from profits from corporations, but those profits, as I said, issue from or stemming from, you know, exploitation. But those profits then become revenues to the government, which uses them to safeguard those interests of the ruling class. But two things need to be said. One, that gets fought out among the powers that be. The rulers, you know, fight it out over what those policies will be and how those benefits will accrue to which sections of the ruling class. So those things are contested and fought out. But the other point is that as much as the imperialist state is essential to the maintenance of this empire and control and repression over the populace, it is also the fact that those revenues that are going into the government coffers are a deduction from the profits of these corporations. So there's that contradiction. And this becomes very, very thorny for them now when their rate of capital investment is not what it needs to be in order to maintain competitiveness in the world economy. And then you have these crisscrossing demands, military spending. They want to boost military. So that is going to require spending. So this now contains within it the seeds of, you know, intense financial crisis. So this is part of that picture as well, that contradiction between the need for this capitalist imperialist state to safeguard the global interests of U.S. capital at the same time that the spending requires taxes, which are a deduction, a subtraction from profits. So this is what's in play as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, Raymond, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And we got to have you back, man, to continue this, continue following this. All right.
Yeah, well, thanks for, you know, for having me on. And I do want to say that, you know, in closing, that this really is a tremendous gamble by this fascist section of the politically dominant section of the U.S. ruling class. And people have to recognize that we are, you know, entering and have entered into this very dangerous moment. And I have to reiterate again the urgency of people uniting to drive this regime from power because of the stakes for the planet and for humanity.
All right, Raymond Lada, thanks again, man. Talk to you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Raymond Lada. Raymond is a revolutionary intellectual and an advocate for Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism. And we were talking about his recent article in RevCom.us. It's actually in Revolution Newspaper in RevCom.us. You can find Revolution Newspaper in RevCom.us. All right, so that's RevCom.us. Find that, and you'll find other pieces on the economy. This is a time, as Raymond ends his article by saying, it's a time for struggle, folks, struggle. All right? We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Prophets of Rage with Hail to the Chief. And now we'll be hearing an interview I did with Claudia Kunz, who is a historian of Nazi Germany. She teaches at Duke University. She wrote the books Mothers in the Fatherland and The Nazi Conscience, as well as other works. And Claudia is speaking with us today on the rise of fascism in Germany and what it has to do with recent developments in the U.S. And I'm very pleased to welcome her to the show. Claudia, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Let's first talk about how, in broad strokes, your book, you pick it up and you start reading it, and it's very difficult to put it down. And it's very difficult to sit there and not, like, have your bones chilled as you're reading it when you're looking at this and you're saying, how the hell did this happen? So in broad strokes, let's talk about how fascism developed in Germany.
Okay, first of all, let's remember that nobody ever heard of Hitler until the early 30s. He was unemployed. The only steady job he ever had in his life was when he fought in World War I for 4 years. He was quite brave. This was a splinter party. In 1928, as late as 1928, 10 years after the defeat in World War I, the Nazis got 2.6% of the vote. 1930, they got 18% of the vote. 1932, they were up to the high point ever, 37.4% of the vote. So the Nazis never were voted into power. Hitler was appointed into power. So the question is, how did this disreputable fringe party of loudmouth, brawling stormtroopers get from a tiny splinter party to the center in 1932? Which put Hitler in position to get appointed as chancellor, because he was like the prime minister, there was a president above him. Okay, what happened was the Great Depression. Suddenly, one-third of all Germans were unemployed. The government was in gridlock. People were desperate. And Goebbels, Hitler's sidekick for media, had an important insight. He said, we can use democracy to kill democracy. We come, this is a famous statement, we come like wolves to the sheepfold. We will take over. And so that's the crucial thing to look at. What happened between 1930 and 1934 that landed Hitler in a position where he was prime minister, chancellor? And part of that answer has to do with the incompetence and the cluelessness of his opponents, who didn't think he was very dangerous until too late. And also, one thing I should remind you of is that the Germans were educated. Their voter turnout was above 88% all the way through the whole Weimar Republic. These were smart people. And Hitler was appointed chancellor January 1933. Still didn't have a majority. He had to get a majority. Then what happened is the Reichstag burned down. It would be like the Congress, the House of Congress, was burned down. The fire was sufficiently bad. Hitler blamed it on the communists. He called the representatives to the Reichstag, kept communists out, and this time there was another election, the national election. Hitler still only got 44% for the Nazis. And finally, in the middle of March 1934, the government, that is, the politicians, did what the people didn't. The politicians caved in and voted Hitler as chancellor. And from that point forward, he just moved so fast, nobody caught up to him.
You know, it kind of models and reminds you of what happened with Trump and the way he got put into office.
Right. So it'll be from completely outside. The outsider has so much credibility just because of their incompetence, because of their lack of experience.
Then you have the Electoral College that actually had some kind of role to play in, like, looks like we're going to put this guy in because we want him.
We are in a lot more trouble constitutionally than Germany was. Germany had a great constitution.
In the book, you talk about the road to Auschwitz was paved with righteousness. And I thought that was an important point for people to think about.
Right. Ordinary people can't do evil unless they see it as good, unless they see it as protective. So until the 1980s, the Germans said, oh, we didn't know anything about it. Then they thought, well, maybe people knew about it, but just an evil, you know, a few bad apples. Then the next question, well, maybe they were just like robots. And I wrote my book, actually, The Mothers and the Fatherland, in this one, to point out that you can't deport from Nazi-occupied territories. You can't have Germans deporting 675,000 other Germans that who were Jewish and unwanted without a lot of collaboration at the local level. And people have to believe that what they are doing is protective, because they believe they're in such great danger, like in a wartime. That's the question. How people feel righteous and good when they do the very evil thing of sending friends and neighbors, betraying friends and neighbors at the grass level, it's collaborating in the actual killing site.
And it's heavy because it's something that gets repeated throughout the entire history of that regime. It's very, very heavy, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, too. But your title of the book is Nazi Conscience, and you begin it by saying that Nazi conscience is not an oxymoron. But as I was telling you earlier, it kind of made my head snap, because, and to many people, the words of Nazi and conscience are never conceived of as two words that would go together anywhere.
We're so naive, we believe that there's a universal conscience, like thou shalt not kill and do unto others. But actually, when you think about it, Freud had this insight, too. He said it's hard to do unto others who are not like yourselves. And that reminds me of a Nazi slogan, do unto others as you would like others to do unto you. But in the German, it's clearer. Others are people like you. Do unto others who are like yourself.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and a Nazi Conscience, and we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. There's another point that you raise in this, which is, again, really struck me. You quote Carl Schmitt, and he was a big Hitler supporter. He denounced the concept of universal human rights when he was questioned about that, and he denounced it by saying, you know, listen, not every being with a human face is a human. And you say that this statement, which just sort of makes your head spin, you say that this is the bedrock of Nazi morality. What do you mean?
What I mean is Schmitt didn't think Jews had a human face. He looked at their faces. A visual is so important. He looked at their faces, and he said, these people are subhumans. There are also people who are racially, well, they're disabled. But he said, these people are not worthy of life. Life unworthy of living was a Nazi medical belief. And so they were able to fence whole categories of human beings outside of the realm of moral obligation. Let me give you an example. A young man in the eighth grade, in 1938, he saw his best friend Heinz being taken off, in 1938, being taken off to a concentration camp. It was his best friend. Heinz and he grew up together. And he said, looking back, his name was Philip, he said, You know, when I saw them taking Heinz, I didn't say, isn't it terrible they're taking Heinz? He said, isn't it a shame that Heinz is a Jew? That's what happened to his conscience. And he grew up later, came to this country, he wrote a book, and he recognized his ways. But that was his view.
When you're talking about that, it's kind of heavy because it's like this point about a normalization that grew up around fascist rule in Germany. And it lasted quite some time. But I keep wondering, how the hell did this happen? There's all these people, like you said, there's these people who thought this, they thought that. They recognized what Hitler was saying, but they thought that it was part of their moral stand or whatever, and that it was something that was okay to be doing for the interests of Germany. How did this happen? And what was this normalization around fascist rule in Germany up until 39? What actually made that work?
Well, let's think about one of the reasons it worked is because Hitler engineered an economic recovery. Hitler understood that he needed experts in his cabinet, for example. His first cabinet had 12 members and only 3 were Nazis. And the genius behind the economic recovery was actually a founding member of the German Democratic Party. And he was a Keynesian. They borrowed tremendously, and here was his formula. Massive rearmament, because Germany had been disarmed after World War I, infrastructure development, lots of big construction projects, and then labor-intensive projects to give people jobs, like the WPA in the United States. And so all that was going on. By 1936, there was no more unemployment. 3 years, unemployment went from 30% to zero. And all this time, Hitler's diplomatic corps, who were extremely skilled, were being appeased by the West. So Hitler was going from one diplomatic victory to another. And so the combination of domestic rebuilding and international prestige made Hitler very popular. And let's also remember, the Germans read Hemingway, they loved Gone with the Wind, they read Faulkner, they drove Fords, they drank Cokes, they went to church. Germans got the first paid vacations of any workers in the world. They went to mass motels and cruise ships. Just the very first week of Nazi power, just for example, and how important the psychology was, the Nazis were geniuses at this. People in small towns that were buildings were looking kind of shabby got free house paint if they repainted the outside of their houses just so it looks better. That's what normalization looked like. And so people then had a kind of yes-but attitude. Yeah, the Nazis are terrible, but look what they did. So there was a record of real achievement that is hard for us to remember, but it was real.
Now, Claudia, let's talk about this. Who was the actual social base for the Nazis and Hitler, and why?
Yeah, first of all, the Germans keep very good records, so we know how every little district voted for the whole 13 years before the Nazis took over. They even tabulated male and female votes separately. How did they do that? They had women vote on white slips and men vote on gray slips. So we have an exact knowledge of who voted for Hitler. And who voted for Hitler, we would call today the left behind. The people who felt that they were not getting a fair share, that the cities were booming, that the wealthy people were doing okay despite the Depression. They had been through a terrible inflation in 1923. They felt they lost everything. These were the left behind. But the other thing we know, because we have such good voting records, is we say, okay, look at the Nazi Party vote increase, and we can see what parties, and there were 5 major parties, which parties lost votes to the Nazis before 33, and who held their own. The parties that held their own votes were the Socialist parties, the Catholic parties, and the Communist parties. These 3 parties were parties that we can't even imagine today because they were subcultures. They had sporting events. They had singing events. They had paramilitary marching. So these 3 categories of voters did not switch their votes for Hitler. We know that women, first-time voters, that is young women and young people, disproportionately voted for Hitler, but a majority of women never voted for Hitler. But that last-minute bandwagon effect was fueled in part by people who'd never voted before, that is young people and women. So that's before 33. After 33, when it became clear that the Nazis would be in power for some time to come, and remember, the Nazis, right from the beginning, were arresting communists. They were arresting people who spoke out against them. The first concentration camp in Dachau was set up in 1933, right away. And suddenly the Nazis became the real party. And ordinary people, middle-class people, began to think, well, maybe it's not so bad because we are not being affected. Our lives are doing better. And course, there's the famous statement by a very famous pastor, Martin Niemöller. Oh, when they came for the socialists, when they came for the communists, I didn't worry. And then they came for the Catholics. Oh, and when they came for me, there was no one left to defend me. And people got seduced.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience, and we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. It's bone-chilling, but it's something that we have to really explore and understand because we're faced with a very similar situation in a lot of ways today in terms of what's going on in the country broadly and what's actually needed. And that reminds me of something because I was thinking about this, and it was very good that there was this large women's march just after Trump's inauguration, but it raised something else to me in terms of the people that need to be in the streets now and doing all kinds of things now to stand up against Trump. And I thought of one thing that in particular people need to understand, because if you went around telling people, look, you're talking about fascism, you're talking about a fascist there, you're talking about somebody who, if you study what happened in Germany, you study that, you study what's happened in other places, but in particular Germany, you look at this and you can draw a lot of line between what goes on with Trump and what was going on with Hitler and the Nazis. Now, you wrote, and I wanted to give people just a sense in general about this, like after the Women's March, I was thinking about your book, Mothers in the Fatherland and Women, the Family, and Nazi Politics, and it was a very heavy book. And I wanted to ask you about that. What did fascism mean for women in Germany? Because it's one thing when you hear about the men and what happened to them and how they were appealed to, and it was all the stuff that was going on specifically aimed at men, but there was a lot of stuff that was happening with women that I thought was very, very heavy and sort of, one, denied their humanity, but two, was something that a lot of people just don't know about in relation to fascism.
Well, that's why I wrote the book, because I was in the 80s and all my friends in Germany said, oh, yeah, my dad was bad, but my mother was really good. And so I went to the archives and I found out that actually when you want to know how Hitler's ideology permeated at the grassroots, women are at the center of that story. They're the mothers who send their kids off to the Hitler Youth. They're the local knitting society that gets brown yarn for free. They call themselves, some of them call themselves, Hitler's little brown geese. Can you imagine? That they were proud of being recognized as women. The head of the organization, I kid you not, the name was really Gertrude Schultz-Klink. Gertrude Schultz-Klink headed up an organization of 9 million women, all out there volunteering, collecting charity for the needy, cooking meals for the hungry, organizing charity. Everything was organized, even charity. And so women felt proud of doing their womanly activities, womanly so-called. And the fact that they were kept out of high places didn't bother them as much as we might think it would. Not that many women were in the universities to begin with.
The other place that actually had a lot to do with like what happened with Hitler's reputation, what happened with fascism in Germany, and how it was rolled out a carpet for them to be received on was in the universities. And the fact that the universities actually were very open to Hitler. And that was something that really, I think, would shock a lot of people. To me, it was interesting because when I saw you really went after Heidegger, I was very happy because you don't know how many arguments I've had with people about Heidegger. And, you know, people always look at him as like, oh, well, you know, we study him. So let's talk about this. What about the universities and the Nazis, the relationship there?
You would think. I work in a university, so I would think that the universities would be the first to see the danger. Not at all. First of all, actually, Jewish professors were overrepresented in the ranks of academe, and 10% of all professors were fired because they were Jewish in 1933. And in a time when there were no jobs available, that meant a lot of PhDs got jobs. So there's that absolutely material benefit. And while we're talking about Jews, also too, middle-class professors were about as anti-Semitic as other people, but while we're talking about Jews, I'd like to ask your listeners to imagine, think of what percentage of all Germans in 1933 were Jewish. Just pause for a minute, get that percentage correct, and I bet not many of you guessed under 1%. So we're looking at a very small population, quite different from the population, the African-American population, which is around 15 to 18% in this country. And so there's a very big difference. And the amount of anti-Semitism in the universities was actually quite strong. And so that was one reason. The other thing that the Hitler administration did is to recruit followers in the universities who would serve as legal experts, who would justify racial politics. The funding dried up for what we would call liberal research, but funding was suddenly available for research in race, how race impacts literature, racial thinking impacts social work. So the racialization of the curriculum meant all kinds of new funding opportunities. And so as we're looking to what's going to happen now about funding for climate change, we can see that kind of incentive system shifting. And so suddenly the availability of jobs, funding, and prestige was irresistible. And I have to say that the historians were particularly awful. They took a lot of the history that had been written by Jews, talking about all of Jews' wonderful contributions in many, many areas, and they took all that research and they said, see, there's been a Jewish conspiracy. They just plagiarized and turned pride into insult. So the universities were not a bastion of free speech.
It's very heavy reading that in your book. In fact, as you go through it and you get all the way up to 39 and the role that the universities played, I mean, they were like steamrollers for Hitler. It was very, very heavy.
They called it the Brown steamroller.
Well, let's talk about this because I want to start getting into some of the similarities between what's happening with the Trump regime and what happened in Nazi Germany. And one of the things I can't help, and I think I wrote to you earlier about this, but you talked a lot about the professional popularizers for the Nazi regime. One put out the booklet called Der Stürmer, and the other was Das Schwarze Korps. And I read this part of the book, I kept thinking about, guess what, Breitbart. And this is kind of right there, you know?
It's right there. And of course, now we look back and this technology was primitive. But the Nazis, and one thing to remember is before 33, no politics on the radio. So radio was not an option. But the Nazis were way ahead of the curve. As soon as electric amplification of the voice became possible, they had it. They had movies. They used film strips. They had 72,000 versions of one slideshow that went out but displayed by the Hitler Youth. They were at the technological front of the media always. They had insiders, newspapers for party members, and huge mass circulation newspaper, their own national news circulation, with fake news, fake facts everywhere. And this was very, very important, that they were technologically night and day more sophisticated than any of their other political rivals.
You know, one thing that I kept thinking about as I was reading about this, now these two, particularly Der Stürmer and Das Schwarze Korps, these were two different publications, right? These were print publications, and one was from the SS and one was from the Stormtroopers, right? And one was geared towards a sort of a more brutish audience, and the other was geared towards a more intellectual audience, it seemed. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, because they understood how to segment their audience. And so that the Stürmer was filled with disgusting anti-Semitic cartoons and outrageous lies, like the National Enquirer. But the Schwarze Korps, which is for the SS, which is the elite, had scientific articles. It had pictures of important people. It looked like a professional association in the day. It had racial science there. It had geopolitics. It had interviews with government dignitaries. It appealed to the elite.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience, and we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. Let me ask you this, and this is something you also have been thinking about a lot as you wrote to me this morning, the structural similarities and situations that encourage racist populism. And, you know, this is exactly what we're looking at when we're looking at the regime in power in the U.S. right now in terms of this kind of encouraging racist populism. And let's talk about that, the structural similarities in these situations.
Well, you know, I can't resist pointing out to one enormous difference. And that is, of course, the structural similarities are here. We have a group of people who feel left out, left behind. But our situation in some ways is different because, and that's why I think fascism isn't so helpful, because we have a unique situation. When you look at the white supremacy tradition in this country, we've been a country that has been for 270 years, my math is probably a little weak, we have been a country where white supremacy has been legal all years except for 77 years. Except for 77 years, we have been a white supremacist country. That didn't exist in Germany. And that makes us structurally incredibly different. And I think we always have to remember we're more like apartheid in South Africa under de Klerk than in that respect than in Nazi Germany. So it's important when we're doing the comparisons to remember that there are some alarming differences too, not necessarily better. But structurally, we have a developed democracy that people take for granted. We think our wonderful history is going to protect us, because we tend to think of history as being upward and onward, always getting better. We don't see it as a battle. We have two traditions in this country, the tradition of the Enlightenment, the tradition of human rights, human dignity, and then we have the tradition of white supremacy, and they're both confronting one another right now. And Germany didn't have that legacy of white supremacy, and the Jewish population was minuscule. So that's one element that makes us different.
What about the similarities on the other hand?
Well, similarities, I can't resist drawing some similarities in the way in which people seem to follow an outsider leader. Now, you can look at Hitler, and of course, he's ridiculous. He's got a shock of hair. He had no political experience. He got the idea for his mustache when he saw his first Charlie Chaplin movie. He had himself, he was extremely vain. He particularly liked that mop of hair that came down in front of his eyes. He had a photographer with him at all times. The photographer took pictures of his gestures, which he repeated. He could not follow a script. He had to extemporaneously speak because he had to have feedback from his audience. And in fact, in 1932, he was so vain, his photographer, personal photographer, took dozens of pictures for him in different poses so that his annual picture wouldn't look aged. He curated an image for himself, the opposite of Trump, but therefore interesting because it was extreme. He's a simple man, a bachelor, a teetotaler, a vegetarian who wore rumpled suits. He appeared kind of harmless. So that, in an odd way, won him the trust of people who were so disillusioned with the main political parties of the day. So from the opposite end of the social scale, we have this outsider capturing the disenfranchised, people who feel disenfranchised, because of an extraordinary ability to understand the media. Hitler also was a master at making headlines of the provocative statement. He would always make outrageous statements. Didn't matter if they weren't so true. He said, tell a lie, tell a big lie. It always leaves a trace.
Let's talk about this. You mentioned to me that you're very worried these days, and I want to talk about that because I think you're not alone, okay?
I'm very worried today because in some ways, Hitler was more cautious. He had to be more cautious because of the Constitution, because there was a president over him, and he never got more than a third of the vote. And there was no voter fraud in Nazi Germany, P.S. I'm very worried because what I see is a president whose ignorance is legendary. And he has a Rasputin, Steve Bannon. Hitler didn't need anybody else. Hitler read whole books, believe it or not. He only remembered what he agreed with, but still. I think I'm worried because we, like the Germans, have a political culture that depends on goodwill and shared norms, politicians who respect those norms. We take it for granted. We're looking at a regime that has a businessman's ethic, and a businessman looks for loopholes and looks at respect for your enemy, so-called, respect for your person in the other party, as being a sign of weakness or stupidity. We also have a track record in this country, a right-wing movement that's extremely well-funded. Read Dark Money from 1973, when ALEC, the think tank that produces legislation for right-wing politicians, was founded, the Koch brothers. Here in North Carolina, we have the Pope brothers. And here in North Carolina, too, we see what you people in California under Jerry Brown don't see. We see how the Republicans are behaving. That is to say, cutting out, finding every loophole, doing absolutely everything they can to block progressive legislation, to cut back the rolls of Medicare. They're ruthless, and we're learning very quickly how to fight that. And it's a steep learning curve, but we've got to learn fast. And that's what scares me. And so the bottom line is, I think what frightens me most is that progressives in pre-Nazi Germany, in late Weimar Germany, progressives were blindsided by the speed and the ruthlessness with which Hitler seized power. And that's what I'm afraid. In a way, I guess, remember Franklin Roosevelt said in the 30s, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. I think the only thing we have to fear is not being afraid enough. Even though the parallels are not perfect with Nazi Germany, what is similar is the weakness of progressives, people of goodwill, liberals, lefties, call them what you will, defenders of human rights, our weakness when confronted with overwhelming force, financial and legal, we hope legal not yet. So that's why I'm scared.
Well, you got me too. Okay, I think everybody in the other room is scared too. It's actually something to be really cognizant of in terms of what's happening among the people themselves. And that's what I wanted to ask you for certain, because it's very much linked to what you just spoke about. What do you want people to take away from this book and the whole thing that you've been laying out here?
Well, what I want them to take away, and I see it here in North Carolina, where we have an incredible movement of resistance. We have still a free press. We have Reverend Barber Moral Mondays. We have grassroots organizations going out everywhere. And we still have a free press. We're still using it. We march. We have mobilizations. And we have a court system that is stronger than they ever had in Nazi Germany. So we need to look at what the resources are we have to mobilize, because we've got a chance as long as we make activism part of everyday life.
Claudia Kunz, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Talk to you again soon.
Thanks.
Take care now.
Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Claudia Kunz, historian of Nazi Germany, author of The Nazi Conscience and Mothers in the Fatherland. The book poses the question, how does it happen that citizens who consider themselves deeply moral can believe that some of their fellow citizens embody a danger so lethal that they must be eliminated? And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my two guests, Raymond Latta and Claudia Kunz. I want to thank my board op for today, my engineer for today, the engineer extraordinaire, Kiana Williams. That's right, Kiana. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and everybody else who worked on the show. It's just me and Henry that worked on the show this week, and Kiana. Okay, so thank you guys. Thanks, everybody. And thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going to go out now with When the Ship Comes In, a cover of Bob Dylan's When the Ship Comes In by Outer National. Talk to you again next week.
Like the stillness in the wind, or the hurricane.